Welcome into a Saturday afternoon edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We are on the eve of our high school reunion, and instead of getting there on time for that, we are taking some time to talk to you about Nets basketball. They fall to the Minnesota Timberwolves 112-102. We're going to get into why they lost this game, what needs to change, and why the product was, at least in my humble opinion, because I haven't talked to Josh about this yet, was so egregious in this one. We'll get into all that and more next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast. I am your host, Gavin Chung, bringing you your daily Nets micropod, all the information you need on the Brooklyn Nets, their games, their humor, their announcers, everything right here on Locked On Nets. And I am joined by the GOAT, the slightly hungover GOAT, Josh Bass, who had himself a night out on the town last night, got up to some hijinks. None of them are fit to share on air, but I am really excited for my guy, Josh. And I hopefully that puts you in a good mood to talk about what was a very depressing Nets game.
Gavin, nothing makes my Saturday morning great like podcasting with you and spending some nice quality time over Google Hangout.
Was that a make Saturday morning great again? Was that a MSMAGA?
You could say that.
Okay, good. All right. Okay, solid. I felt dirty even, so I don't even want to joke about that. But anyways, it was a 112-102 win for the Minnesota Timberwolves over the Brooklyn Nets. Derrick Rose dropped a cool 25 spot on them. And I don't know about how you felt about this game, Josh. You watched it live. You watched the game a day ahead of me. Watching it this morning, it was just like, it was depressing. It was like a slog, and maybe like I woke up feeling a little out of it. I wasn't in like a great mood to begin with, but I don't know. This game was just like torture for me. Like I usually watch the Nets, and like I'm always like, it's like a thing. Like you have to sit down 2 hours and watch a game, and that's fine. Like when you watch every single one, sometimes it's a little bit of a drag. But generally, like I think like especially when Caris LeVert is healthy, like the Nets are a good product, and like I end up really enjoying myself once I get into the game. This one, I couldn't wait for it to be over.
Yeah, I think it started, I mean, the first 4 or 5 minutes, the Nets offense was just a complete disaster, hoisting up threes. No one was really moving. No one was creating anything at the rim. It was a noon start for the guys right after Thanksgiving. They're going to be a little sluggish, but a lot of turnovers. Definitely not a crisply played game between this one and the one against Miami. So the Nets are, they've gotten off to a couple rough starts, and they need a remedy of that.
Yeah, I don't know, and I think you actually tweeted something about this from the LON account, but to me, like, some of this is just a reality without Caris LeVert, because the real issue is they just don't have any kind of juice off the dribble, and I'm pretty sure that's directly what you said, and I'm in total agreement with you, and D'Angelo Russell, you never know who you're going to get on a night-to-night basis. I mean, again, I think a lot of it is the product of how well he's shooting, and he's an inconsistent shooter, so that's just the reality with him, and I think people forget that when he's playing well, and they forget that when he's playing poorly. But even beyond him, there's just no one else in that lineup that can really do much attacking. And to your point, when LeVert first got hurt, I think that's why you expected Dinwiddie to start, and that's why you convinced me it was the right idea for Dinwiddie to start. And without him, like, I don't know what they're expecting. There's just no one who's really going to win off the ball. And when you're not winning off the ball, it's very, very hard to create ball movement.
Yeah, you just summed it up perfectly, Gav. I hate to give you credit, but it's really on the ball.
Yeah, no, that's tough, yeah.
I don't think that Allen Crabbe and Joe Harris should be playing together, and also Damari Carroll and RHJ should be playing together. It seems pretty clear to me that each one of the guys from each pair should be together, so maybe moving Damari or RHJ into this. I mean, I guess not RHJ, but maybe Damari for Allen Crabbe. I don't know. Just try something, because the starting lineup, even though it's been a small sample size with these five guys, it's just clear that it's not going to work. And all of them on their own have their faults. They have their strengths as well. But when you put them all together, it's doing a disservice to D'Angelo Russell, because now he has to create everything. And also Harris and Crabbe, that's not their role.
No, absolutely. And I think to your point, like, yeah, from D'Lo's perspective, that is kind of unfair, because he's not a great attacking point guard to begin with. But I think we're kind of seeing this with the Celtics a little bit, who obviously have way, way more talent than the Nets do. But even with someone like Kyrie Irving, doesn't necessarily draw a lot of fouls, but is as good as anyone in the league at creating penetration and creating passing sequences off those penetration, or at least creating buckets at the rim off that penetration, like, the rest of the Celtics don't really do anything, and it creates this stagnant offense, and D'Lo isn't even in Kyrie's universe as an attacker, so I think that makes it so, so difficult. I mentioned this to you in our 2 minutes of pre-show planning. We were typically prepared for this
20 minutes. 20 minutes.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I guess we were texting 20 minutes out, so let's call it that. Well, let's call it a day, even, because we were thinking about doing this a day ago. All right. In our day of pre-show planning, we were talking about, or at least I was mentioning, how I was so disappointed with Hollis Jefferson and Carroll, and, like, obviously Carroll, like, not, like, and statistically had a decent game, 13 points, 7 boards on 9 shots, whatever, that's neither here nor there. Just aesthetically watching those two guys play, like, Carroll just looks, like, washed, and I think you said it last podcast, like, a step slower than last year, and Hollis Jefferson to me has been, like, maybe the most, I think, outside of Crab, who I just kind of expect to suck in general, like, he's been maybe the most frustrating guy to watch for me. And those two playing together, it's like it's like something out of, like, the early, like, 90s or late 90s of NBA offense. It's just so, so ugly. And again, I think to your point, like, playing one of the shooters with one of those guys remedies that to a degree, but I think the long-term solution is, like, I don't know if those guys should be on this team forever. I don't know if Rodions Karuch should maybe be playing over one of those two guys. Like, I think just something dramatic has to change with no Caris LeVert, because those flaws just become so, so apparent without him.
Yeah, I mean, the Nets at this stage aren't a good team, so I think it's tough to – there's a lot of players with faults, but at the end of the day – just given the current roster, there's not a lot that Kenny can do. But I do see what you're saying with RHJ, because he's really tried to fashion himself into this, like, number one or number two option, and that's really not what he should be doing, in my opinion, for the good of his career. He should be a guy who is really primarily focused on the defensive end and on the offensive end, instead of trying to create buckets and go one-on-one, mainly just kind of focus on offensive rebounding, scoring off putbacks, making timely cuts, instead of trying to go one-on-one. So thinking about a guy like Dorian Finney-Smith on the Dallas Mavericks, who the Nets just played, and he's someone whose three-point shot has really come along a lot, but he's such a lower usage player. I mean, RHJ's usage rate is at 23, and Finney-Smith's at 13. So RHJ has to realize that last year the Nets didn't have a lot of options. He blossomed into a decent one-on-one creator, but when he's on a good team, or even a decent team like the Nets are right now, they're not terrible, even though I just said they were a couple minutes ago. He has to realize that it's not what's going to lead to the most long-term success, because he's only going to be that primary option on a 20-25 win team. And if anything better than that, he can't be expected to score, and he shouldn't want to, really.
Well, and here's the other issue. The version of Hollis Jefferson last year was he was relatively efficient from two-point range, and he was a terrible three-point shooter. And the fact is, like, he shot so well from two-point range on an offense that was pretty bad. That was kind of sustainable as an option. This season, he's down from 47% on field goals to 40%. From three-point range on, again, an insignificant amount of attempts, he's down from 24% to 7%. Free throws, he's down from 79% to 63%.
Free throws is a big one, I think.
I think all of it's important. On one less free throw a game. So I think you take all that into account, where he was already, just because of the nature of his game, it's almost, if you're not a center, it's essentially, in my mind, impossible to be an efficient scorer in the NBA today if you can't shoot threes. I think that's just the reality of it. Hollis Jefferson, in the archetype of that 90s-style wing that wouldn't shoot threes, he was the closest version of that that's still palatable in today's NBA last year. When he's shooting 40% from the field and 7% from three, that becomes impossible. He's no longer that's a guy who, in my mind, should be unplayable on a team with playoff aspirations, even unless he's a great defender. And Hollis Jefferson is not that. So I think, to me, that, like, all that taken into account, that's where I'm so frustrated, and that's where I think this is a real issue for Brooklyn. Josh, I want to give you a chance to respond, but we're going long. Let's take this into a second segment. We'll finish up on Hollis Jefferson, and then we can get into some final points on this game next on the Locked On Nets podcast. We are back on the Locked On Nets podcast, and Josh, before we get into anything else, I want to give you a chance to respond to that point on Hollis Jefferson, because to me, you just look at the shot distribution for, or rather, I guess, the efficiency distribution for him, and it's just glaring that there's, and again, only 16 games so far, but there's just something really wrong there.
Yeah, I think that you're making a lot of good points, Gav. Again, you're on fire today. But really, my main thing with Rondé is that last year he was more efficient and he had decent efficiency, but he really just lives off the mid-range. He's not an explosive finisher. He's not a guy who can really, I mean, even though he's nowhere near the player that a guy like Giannis is or ever will be, Giannis can live off the mid-range, and also he can attack the basket and finish easily with layups and dunks. Mm-hmm. Rondé's always doing some kind of circus shot or spin shot that's really, it's going to lead to lower efficiency even when he's firing on all cylinders for him like last year. I think he needs to do something because the way he's going right now, I don't see the Nets extending him. Maybe he needs to rebrand, just go get rid of the Rondé and just go by Hollis Jefferson, like a Hollis Thompson type from now on.
I kind of like it, yeah. And Hollis Thompson is doing so well now with that name, like it'll just be two Hollises that are great.
Exactly. Is Hollis Thompson in the NBA?
No, he's definitely not.
He was a good 3-point shooter.
It's okay. He's solid. Yeah, I couldn't tell you where Hollis Thompson is. Any thoughts on? I mean, I think I don't. The thing is with Damari Carroll, like I think the Nets are gonna have to throw in like a second round pick to get rid of him at some point. And like I get that, like he's like
no, because he's expiring. They can just wait.
I guess so, but like, what team has like do like does like a contender have room to take on the amount of money he's making this year? I mean, I guess the whole thing is like it may be like the Nets like offer to like pay for half his contract or something, like, because I guess you can do that in a trade. You can cover part of that deal, and like maybe then you could get him to a team like Houston, but then do you even get anything back? Like, is it worth it? Like, and maybe it's worth it just to clear the rotation spot for someone like Karutz. I kind of think the most likely scenario is like the Nets buy him out at some point.
Yeah, I think maybe as part of like a three-teamer, like if Washington's trading one of their guys who all have big salaries, there could be some three-team wizardry that Sean Marks can do, pun intended on that. But I mean, is he an upgrade over Wilson Chandler? Would Philly want him? Because Chandler is a big salary.
Is he? I don't think he is at this point. I don't know. Maybe we really haven't, like, maybe it's unfair with Carroll because we haven't seen that much of him. Like, he's only been back like 5-6 games at this point.
Longer than that. No, he's probably been back for...
Has he? Yeah, again,
I feel like he kind of is what he is this year. 9 games. Okay. He's shooting 31% from the field.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with Carroll is, like, I think if he's shooting over 36% from three, he has value. If he's shooting under 36% from three, I think he has no value at this point in his NBA career.
Nets have looked to trade him in the offseason because he was coming off a good year. He had 1 year left on his deal. He definitely could have helped a lot of teams. I mean, maybe he's always the type of guy that teams are going to look for around midseason when they have a better idea of their team. But I think he definitely had some value this offseason.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I think if the Nets were, I mean, again, this is something that we would typically credit Sean Marks for. I think if they were looking ahead a little bit and they maybe had some idea that Karutz would be a palatable rotation player, and theoretically with how bad Carroll's been, maybe even a better player than Damari Carroll this year. It sounds crazy based on preseason expectations, but I mean, we haven't seen enough of Karutz to confirm or deny that, but could be true given how bad Carroll is. Like, it's a low standard at this point. Like, I don't know. I think maybe that's something Sean Marks like should have seriously consider this offseason. But again, like, the Nets were just so much in like let's get the 8 seed mode that maybe that's something that they didn't even think about, like downgrading in that position, because it would almost be like a sign that they're saying like, oh, we still like the goal is still just to like get the young guys as many minutes as possible, not win as many games, which honestly probably should have been the goal either way, even not knowing about that Caris LeVert injury. Did you have any final thoughts on this game? I like, there wasn't like that much more to take away from me. Like, I liked how Napier played for the most part. I liked how Dinwiddie played, though. I thought, obviously, the hero ball shot when the Nets were down. We were somehow down by just 4 with 2 minutes left. I thought that essentially cost them the game. Outside of that, I thought he was good. And I don't know. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can go rapid fire. I think Dinwiddie played a decent game. I mean, between him and Taj Gibson, I think the two people in the league who complain the most about the officiating, I think Dinwiddie, I love Dinwiddie, but if he wasn't on the Nets, I could see how fans would get so frustrated by him, just because literally every time he goes to the basket, he wants a call.
Sure.
And I think I don't think the refs were great this game. I think they missed a lot of potential fouls, but he played pretty well. That one play where he pulled up from three, he definitely should have tried to take it to the basket, but there wasn't a lot of space just because RHJ is standing at the 3-point line where his man's allowed to help off.
Right.
And give Towns some help. So I don't know why he would even think him standing at the 3-point line is a good idea, because he gets no respect out there. I mean, Derrick Rose, I thought, was awesome. His comeback was definitely for real. Taj Gibson played well. What do you think of them going small with RHJ on Towns? Because I thought it was clearly not going to work, but whatever.
No, I tended to agree with you. And he actually, like, he did have that one play, like, right after Allen fouled out, where they immediately went to Towns on the post, and RHJ blocked him. So that was kind of a good moment, but I don't think that's sustainable at all. And again, the whole thing with that is like the idea of going small in those situations is that you have a five man who can shoot the three. If Hollis Jefferson can't shoot the three, what's really the benefit of going small? Like, I mean, theoretically, like you're a little bit more dangerous in transition. And if you can push the ball up the court, like Towns is going to have a hard time chasing down Hollis Jefferson. But how many times have we really seen like the Nets this season, like push off or make or miss even? Like maybe this is something like we could do a whole podcast on, like, because I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but I would tend to assume the Nets are one of the worst teams in the NBA in transition scoring.
Yeah, they're pretty bad, and they don't do it a lot, and they're bad when they do it. Yeah, I mean, a couple other things from this. I don't know. I think Ed Davis has played so well this year that he deserved a longer leash. Where I think he needs to be they shouldn't need to go to anyone else besides Jared Allen or Ed Davis at the five, unless there's like severe foul trouble, which Allen was in. So who knows? Napier, I thought you touched on him a bit. He was good, but like when he's not hitting shots, he's just so bad, just because his handle's really loose. He's not that great of a passer. He's pretty turnover prone in general. What do you think of him?
Yeah, I kind of have the same feeling you do, where he clearly shot the ball exceptionally well this game, but I don't necessarily feel like he played a great game overall. And I think, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of the story of his career. Like, I think he's just somewhat limited by his size as an attacker, because he can kind of pull off that Nash dribble where he circles the hoop. But the key in those situations, and the reason someone like Dinwiddie and even Russell to an extent are fairly effective in those situations, is because they have enough length around the basket to kind of throw wraparound passes to bigs. And I feel like Napier's like lack of size like really hurts him there. And he almost like I think he's smart enough to realize like he doesn't have that length. And unless he just clearly like just wrecks someone off the dribble one-on-one, he doesn't necessarily have enough room to find a big underneath the basket, and it's kind of difficult for him even to pick out shooters from underneath the rim. So I think that limits him to a degree as a point guard. Overall, I mean, I think he's nice in the role that he's playing, but that obviously is what kind of caps his upside as a player.
Yeah, agreed. I think all the Nets point guards right now have some flaws. I think Spencer Dinwiddie is the one who's the least problematic. Just because even last night when he came in for the first time, the offense flowed immediately better. He has the speed to break down the defense. And I think Russell definitely has better natural passing vision. But unfortunately, when you can't get into the lane to make the defense help, there's no point. Like, you can't utilize that vision, because there's no shooters that are open for you to find.
Right. Yeah, I guess that, by the way, the Nets are, they're 28th in the NBA in transition points to culminate that. They have less than 100 on the season. Yeah, I think that's pretty much, unless you have any final points, that's everything I had to say about this game. I thought the jersey exchange between the Nets broadcast and the Timberwolves broadcast was kind of funny. And then I thought it was kind of awkward when there was just like them saying nice things about each other, like 4 minutes into the broadcast. But that's not really an issue.
Yeah, it was a little much, but happy for Sarah that she got a jersey.
Yeah, that was cool.
And those guys, yeah. They got some also.
Yeah, Yo's here. They seem like two of the nicest broadcast crews in the league. I will say that. All right. That wraps up this segment of Locked On Nets. Let's talk some trades in the third segment. Some rapid fire trade talk coming up next on Locked On Nets. Third and final segment on the Locked On Nets podcast. Before I head to my high school 5-year reunion, just thrilling stuff. All right, Josh, let's talk some trades. We were going to get into this last podcast, and we got into the Ben Simmons, Luka Doncic debate, which was one of my favorite like incidental conversations we've ever had on this podcast. And I wonder, maybe we should tweet it out a little bit more, because I feel like that's something a lot of people would be interested in. But we were going to get into just kind of the trade rumors around the NBA and whether the Nets could get involved with either of them. The two biggest stories, obviously, with the Washington Wizards in regard to their locker room that just seems to be finally broken after years of teetering on the edge. And then the Markelle Fultz situation, where he apparently wants to go to a new team. And that situation, even though I probably should have recognized it, but it still, at least in my mind, almost spiraled out of control faster than I could have imagined, because this offseason you were hearing all that stuff about, okay, Fultz is going to come back a completely different player. I was obviously super duper in on him this offseason, and I was very vocal about that on the podcast, and he comes back the exact same guy. Now he wants to get dealt. So both those situations are awful, do you see an avenue where the Nets could take advantage of either?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the Fultz situation, unless the Sixers want D'Angelo Russell, I'm not sure who they could offer. Maybe like Damari Carroll for. I mean, at that point, you just should hold on to Fultz. I don't see a good route for him to go to the Nets, unless they want to do D'Lo for Fultz, which I don't know if that would work out for either team really. But who knows? I think on Washington, it's a bit more interesting. Kelly Oubre is a guy I'd want to get my hands on somehow if we could, or even Bradley Beal, that might be a pipe dream. But I think most realistically is Otto Porter, just because the Nets seem to love him and also love going after guys where they tried to do the offer sheet, it didn't work, and then they can get them a year later.
What do you see? Like, I'm trying to think, like, I guess, like, if the Nets offered their first round pick this year, and then I don't know, maybe one of their young wings, like maybe like Harris, like, does that get it done for Porter? Is that too much in your mind? Like, what do you think about that?
I think from a value standpoint, that's fine. But I mean, who wants Porter on this contract? I think
they don't need him.
Match salary because he makes $26 million. So it would have to be something where they see Porter as a negative on his current deal. And then the Nets would trade like Damari Carroll or someone, or maybe Crabb has to be involved even.
Yeah.
But I don't even know if they want Porter on that contract, because I wouldn't at least.
Right.
What about a Kelly Oubre for, what's his face? Jana Musa swap. Let's say the Wizards don't want to pay Oubre. I think he has some decent upside. Maybe the Nets say, hey, we already have Kurucs, who's really good. Let's take a chance on a really good athlete in Oubre, who had a decent shot last year. It's kind of fallen apart to start the season, but he's definitely a guy that's made incremental improvements between when he came into the league out of Kansas when he was super raw to what he is now.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty, like, neutral on Oubre. Like, he's just never, like, had, like, a consistent stretch of basketball in my mind, like, outside of the beginning of last year where he was shooting pretty well. He's just one of those guys who I lean more towards the fact, like, oh, like, he's been developed. Like, here's the thing. I'm a long-time suffering Suns and Knicks fan, and for years they've had so many guys like this.
A long time suffering Suns fan. You're a recent Suns fan.
Well, no, I mean, I'm a Suns fan going, I guess I wasn't suffering, but I mean, a Suns fan going back to like the Nash days. So I mean, I wasn't suffering at that. I was suffering in the playoffs. I wasn't suffering in the regular season at that point. But I would say the Suns even more so than the Knicks, like over the Ryan McDonough era. They just had a million guys like this where like they're constantly like, oh wait, there might be something. Oh wait, there might be something. And they never, outside of TJ Warren, who's been very good this year, they usually don't ever end up being anything. And I lean more in that direction with Oubre. Obviously, if you're giving up someone like Musa, like maybe like, again, like it's like you don't think that much of Musa and it's like a net neutral. So like, fine, go ahead, give him a chance. But like, to me, that doesn't really like move the needle like either direction. Like I'm so neutral on that. Like if.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be that good. I mean, he can't hurt. Like, I mean, and again, like this is kind of the state of the Nets, like where like, oh, like if you might get excited about Kelly Oubre, that's kind of an indictment on where your franchise is. But yeah, I mean, they could do it. I don't know. Maybe you might have watched more of him than me, and maybe you see stuff that I don't see. He's never impressed me that much. But
I think he was super overrated in college. Like he was top five recruit, didn't have a good year there. But I think he's been really good. He's developed really nicely, and he's still only a decent role player. But he's 22. He has really good athleticism, so that's the kind of player you want to take a chance on because he has the raw tools. Mm. And his nickname is Wave Poppy. So I'm confused on what you're not getting that that I am.
I can't argue with that. My final point in this pod is I'd be interested to see what the Sixers would say in a D'Lo for Fultz hypothetical, and I'm not sure where the Sixers front office is on Fultz. Like part of me feels like they won't want to admit defeat, and they're gonna try and hold on to him, and they're gonna like take this at least another season. Like that's honestly what I would do if I were them. But maybe the fact that Colangelo's out and Elton Brand is in makes that a little bit different, because he can kind of wipe his hands clean of it and say, look, like that was a terrible mistake, and it wasn't my fault. I wasn't the guy who made the decision to take Fultz instead of trade a first round pick in the process. Maybe that makes it a little bit more palatable for them. But to me, like if I were the Sixers, that's honestly something I would think about, because I don't think that's an awful situation for D'Lo. Like, even though, again, you can question just how good of a shooter he is, that's kind of what they need. Like, someone at the point guard D'Lo has up to this point needed the ball in his hands, but I could see him kind of as a secondary creator and someone who helps run a bench unit for them, and someone who playing alongside other stars is more of a shooter slash secondary attacker. because I think kind of long-term, and if he's willing to accept that as his destiny, that's kind of the best role for his skill set. So I'm wondering if that might actually be a good fit, especially considering the Sixers can make up for his deficiencies defensively, while the Nets like get a guy that theoretically, like, maybe it's a small chance at this point, but does have some upside in Markelle Fultz. So that's kind of where I'm at on that hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely still open to taking a shot on Fultz because he still is very talented. And if he can ever figure out this shot thing in his shoulder, then he could still be a good player. D'Lo would be interesting on Philly. There's a couple things that I would like about that just because he is a really good catch and shoot guy and he can get hot in a hurry. I think he fits well with Simmons actually because Simmons really struggles in the half court. Maybe D'Lo, they both need another guy. So maybe combining those two could create some synergies. And D'Lo could do a nice job once Simmons opens up the defense, maybe attacking where he already has an advantage. He doesn't need to beat his man directly one-on-one. But I think he'd struggle playing with Embiid and Butler. And also, here's the thing, do they want to pay him this offseason? Probably not. So, I don't know. I think from a team perspective, McConnell actually might fit better than D'Lo, even though
yeah.
Russell has a lot more raw talent.
Interesting. I think one thing to note there, D'Lo and Ben Simmons were also high school teammates, so maybe the Sixers like that synergy, or they see it as a means to keep Simmons long-term. I don't know if they're actually good friends. Who knows? But hypothetically, that would be interesting, and that is what we do on this podcast. Hypotheticals. Josh Bass, enjoy the rest of your weekend. I know I will be hopefully enjoying mine as well. The Nets play a game tomorrow, so we will likely have another podcast for you on Monday. Until then, be well. Enjoy some time with your family. Try and limit the political arguments you get into, even though they are probably inevitable. Peace out.